Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
The information depicted in this podcast is purely for informational purposes only. Please consult your healthcare professional before making any changes to your lifestyle or routine.
Hey everyone, and welcome to the Boost Your Biology podcast. My name is Lucas, and I am the founder of Ergogenic Health. Together in this podcast series, we will go underground to explore cutting-edge health and human performance insights that you simply cannot search on Google to help you upgrade your existence. So, without any further ado, let's jump into today's episode. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Boost Your Biology podcast. Today, I have a special guest joining me in who is an expert on metabolic health, hormones, and anti-aging modalities. So joining me in on the show is Chandler Mars. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Awesome. Chandler, do you want to let my listeners know a little bit about, I guess, your story and your background?
Well, it's long and complicated. I started my work in neuroendocrinology, hormones in the brain, particularly in perinatal women, pregnant and postpartum women. And following that, somehow I wound up in the mitochondria. And from there, my latest research has involved the role of nutrients and the functioning of the mitochondria.
Amazing. So I guess maybe, do you want to explain to my listeners just the basics of, you know, the mitochondria and some of its major functions in the body?
Well, so mitochondria are the powerhouses of your cells. They produce something called adenosine triphosphate, ATP, something we all learned about probably in high school biology and pretty much put in our back pocket and moved along and figured that as long as we provided our body with sufficient food, meaning we weren't starving ourselves, that the mitochondria would do their thing and produce ATP. Well, it turns out they need more than just sufficient calories and macronutrients. They need micronutrients, vitamins and minerals. And a lot of us are deficient in those vitamins and minerals because of the diets that we choose to consume. Diets that, while fortified with vitamins and minerals, also carry with them a high carbohydrate burden and a high toxicant burden. So oftentimes, the mitochondria do not produce sufficient energy to power all of the functions that we need them to power. And that's where you get disease processes in the lack of energy, but also in the adaptive processes that take place to compensate for that lack of energy. And that's been the body of my research and writing for the last, 5 or 6 years.
Amazing. And one area that I guess
you're quite well known for is in the field of vitamin B1 and how that impacts mitochondrial function. So do you want to let my listeners know maybe a little bit of background around vitamin B1 and I guess its major functions associated with energy production?
So vitamin B1, also called thiamine or thiamine, depending upon who you're speaking with, was the first B vitamin that was synthesized back in, I think, the 20s or 30s. But its deficiency was recognized centuries ago. The conditions that it causes, you may have heard beriberi or Wernicke's encephalopathy, were recognized as early as 7th century China. The physicians there were writing about it, and the same symptoms that we see today, they were writing about that all the way back then. And so thiamine, the reason it's so important is because it is geographically located at the entry points to mitochondrial energy metabolism, the entry points for carbohydrate metabolism, and the peroxisome for the entry point to fatty acid metabolism, and at an important juncture in amino acid metabolism. It is also critical to several of the enzymes within the mitochondria, such that when it is deficient, everything else goes crazy and has to compensate. Unlike all of the other vitamins, because of its location and its rate-limiting step, it does, in fact, limit the rate of ATP production. And so it causes deficiencies in other vitamins and minerals and just a host of problems. And one of the key things I think that is missing in all of the conversations we have about vitamin B1 is that it's considered rare deficiency in developed countries where food fortification has been in place since the 40s. But it's not rare because a lot of the foods we eat demand more thiamine than we are getting in those foods and carry, as I said, a heavy toxicant burden. So a lot of the disease processes we see, all the metabolic dysfunction we see that just pervades or is endemic in Western countries, the diabetes, the heart disease, even Alzheimer's, which is now considered another form of diabetes, evolve relative to, I believe, lack of thiamine and other nutrients in the diet.
Mm, awesome. Okay. Those yeah, really, really well explained. One element there, I guess, that we can sort of touch on or expand upon is the influence of a high carbohydrate diet and how that will automatically increase the body's need for vitamin B1. So do you want to explain why that's the case?
Well, think about, you know, you've got to metabolize those carbohydrates. And thiamine is at the entry point of glucose metabolism. A couple of the enzymes that it takes, that it is involved with, called the pyruvate dehydrogenase complex, it's a complex of enzymes, is at the entry point. It takes pyruvate and converts it to acetyl-CoA, and that's the first step in getting into the mitochondria. And when it is shunted, then stuff goes off into secondary and tertiary pathways. Mm-hmm. The initial secondary pathway is through what's called the pentose phosphate pathway and the transketolase enzyme. Again, thiamine dependent. And so when those don't work, they end up in these other what are called salvage pathways. And those salvage pathways don't burn as cleanly, if you will. So they produce a lot more reactive oxygen species and a lot more other toxicants that the body has to deal with. And so then you get this kind of cycle, more toxicants, less energy, more toxicants, less energy, more toxicants, less energy, and so on and so forth, until you've got disease.
Mm, okay, great. And one element there I want to sort of touch on is, I guess, people talk about when we're in a high glucose oxidating state or oxidative metabolism, mm-hmm. we're generating more CO2. So do you want to sort of expand, is that a good thing and what's that's role in energy metabolism?
Well, that's a different reaction altogether. And it's not necessarily a good or bad thing. It depends on whether or not you have the capacity to further metabolize everything. Mm-hmm. And so it's not one of the things that I don't like about the way we talk about health and disease is this binary either or function that this metabolite is good and that metabolite is bad. It's not that simple. There's gradations of good and bad, and there are times when all of these adaptive mechanisms, one of the adaptive mechanisms you get when thiamine is reduced is you get the induction of what's called hypoxia-inducible factors, HIFs, or proteins. HIFs. Hypoxia-inducible factor proteins. There we go. And that is because you're not able to consume molecular oxygen particularly well. And so you get this state of hypoxia based on just a nutrient deficiency. It's not like an ischemic hypoxia or an obstructive hypoxia. There's plenty of oxygen floating around, but the mitochondria can't use them to produce energy. So when those HIFs become stabilized, then they initiate all sorts of other reactions. Now, those reactions are necessary to maintain oxygen homeostasis. And they are there because we want them there acutely. Mm-hmm. What happens is when you get this system going on chronically, you get disease, you get inflammation, you get cancer, you get all of these other end products relative to this molecular hypoxia. And so while in and of themselves, you can't say that the HIFs are good or bad. They're necessary. It's a necessary part of biology. You wouldn't want not to be able to react to hypoxia. It would kill you. So as with everything, there's good and bad. It's complicated.
As always with science, it's always
It's not an either or. It's never an either or. And I don't like that. We do that with deficiency, nutrient deficiencies too, and diseases. Everything is to a marker. You know, if you have X levels of this nutrient, you are healthy, but just one nanomole less and you are unhealthy by definition. And that just makes absolutely no sense because it's a gradation on that scale. And then that doesn't take into consideration the individual, the host reactions. While X percentage of people may be considered healthy with this amount of thiamine or B12 or any other, individually, you may need a heck of a lot more. And so I think we need to get past these kind of binary descriptions of disease.
Mm. I guess something that also came to my mind is if you were to, I guess, talk to someone and explain to them, hey, this is what you should do to respect and improve and support your mitochondrial function. What, obviously, we know that correcting nutrient deficiencies is important and exercise and things like that. But if you were to suggest to someone, here's what you should do to really look after your mitochondria, what would you tell them?
Well, I don't think we can minimize eating real food and moving. Those two things are critical, and we don't do those very well. We tend to eat conventionally grown produce, which is laden with pesticides, and then processed foods, which has all sorts of chemical additives and all of that, that's not food. That carries a higher toxic burden. And then, of course, movement. But if we were going to look at how to repair mitochondria individually, there's a chart in Chapter 3 of our book that outlines all of the nutrients needed to make the wheels of the mitochondria turn. I would go down and around that circle and see what you need. And you may need several of them. You may need, only one or two. But if you don't replenish those nutrients, then you're not going to be able to be healthy and or heal from whatever it is you're trying to do. But the flip side of that is you've got to remove the toxicants because no amount of vitamin or mineral supplementation is going to replace a toxic diet, a toxic environment, all of those toxic burdens that modern living thrusts at us.
Mm, that's great. I guess then let's sort of circle back to vitamin B1 in relation to chronic fatigue syndrome, because I do remember seeing one study where they did use high dose, quite high doses of vitamin B1. And I remember some quote in the study saying a complete amelioration of fatigue was seen in, I don't know, 60% of patients.
It's very common. Fatigue is probably the cardinal symptom of mitochondrial dysfunction, whether it be mediated by thiamine or any other variable. If your mitochondria are not producing ATP, you're going to be fatigued. That's, you know, just is. And so when we look at fatigue as a kind of a benign symptom, but it's really an indication of poor mitochondrial function. So with regard to the high dose thiamine, high dose is, again, it's not a necessarily a straightforward concept, because by definition, anything over a milligram a day is high dose. So, yeah, so you have to keep that in mind.
Yeah.
That is the bare minimum. It's 1.2 and 1.4 milligrams per day is what the recommended daily amount of thiamine is. It hasn't been changed in 80 years. And even when they established it 80 years ago, there was research saying that this really is not sufficient to promote health. It was simply the bare, absolute bare minimum to prevent frank deficiency. With regard to high dose, individuals who have been chronically ill, where their mitochondria affect, which their mitochondria are always impacted, are likely to need much higher doses of thiamine and other nutrients to recover than would be suggested by either the RDAs or even standard vitamin supplements. What those doses are, though, varies significantly between individuals. And so everybody wants a protocol. Take this at this dose and all will be well. You can't do that, particularly when you're dealing with a chronic condition that has a whole host of compensatory reactions that have been elicited to keep that human being alive and functioning. So, yes, high-dose thiamine can do remarkable things in a lot of instances. Something you'll notice is it's not always a linear recovery process, though, and it's not always an easy recovery process. While the cases you see in the hospital, the acute cases where there's frank thiamine deficiency, typically in alcoholics or someone who's severely ill, or you will often read that, you know, they were declining, they were at death's door, and then we gave them, you know, X hundred milligrams of thiamine, and within, you know, a couple hours, they turned around, you know. And while that is true, it doesn't tell the entirety of the story. There's a lot more to it that has to be unwound that takes a significant amount of time and effort past that very acute phase. And most folks with chronic illness don't get to that acute phase, but they're still significantly ill and still require that type of care, but they have to do it outpatient and they have to do it over an extended period of time. And it's a long and arduous process.
Right. Okay. One thing that I guess confuses me is with, as with any nutrient or vitamin, if we high dose, then we're potentially offsetting the balance with its synergistic nutrients. So is there a link there with potentially B2 acting as a...
Well, certainly, because B2 is another cofactor in the pyruvate dehydrogenase enzyme complex. And so as is alpha-lipoic acid, and magnesium is required whenever you take thiamine to activate the thiamine. So you need that. And then oftentimes, once you get kind of that going, you start kicking these other enzymes into activity. And so it starts using up the other nutrients that you may have not been technically deficient in, but now it's using them. Whereas before everything was floating around and not being accessed, now they're using them. So you can become deficient in other of the B vitamins in particular, and certainly a lot of other vitamins. And so, it's never recommended to just take thiamine by itself. In fact, it's never recommended to just take one nutrient by itself. Right. One of the things that is commonly done that is very popular that is high-dose magnesium therapy. And while I agree that magnesium is critically important, so many people are deficient in, if you do high-dose therapy, magnesium therapy, and you're deficient in thiamine, you're actually going to shut the cycle down. Because, at another one of the enzymes that thiamine is important to, it's a rate limiting, it will kick everything and shut it down. So everything has to always be in a balance as you do this. And that's why it's never as easy as like the case studies suggest in acute care. In chronic care, it's an entirely different proposition.
Right. That makes sense. Actually, I had a really great chat with Elliot Overton from...
Yeah, I saw... I didn't listen to it. I apologize. But I did see that you had talked to Elliot.
So. Yeah, we had a brilliant discussion around some of the different forms of vitamin B1, and he talked heavily around the TTFD form. So I'd love to hear your, you know, maybe what you've seen clinically or what you've researched around.
So So TTFD is the most bioavailable form amongst the currently available. I can't remember the name, but there's another one being tested synthetically right now that's supposed to be even more active, but it hasn't come on the market. When you decide to supplement with thiamine, you have to pick a formulation of the thiamine. And there are different formulations with varying degrees of absorbability and potency. TTFD and bimbotiamine being the most bioavailable, most absorbable because of their structure. They can cross fatty layers. They're described as being fat soluble. They're not technically fat soluble. They can get through the membrane because they don't need transporters. On that other scale, on the other end, the least well absorbed but still useful are thiamine mononitrate and hydrochloride. The fatigue study that you saw used the thiamine hydrochloride, and I think they were taking 2 grams of it.
Yeah.
I was 1,800 to 2,000 milligrams of it. And a dose like that would be comparable to, because of the absorbability factor, a lot less of the TTFD. Although some people take up to several grams of TTFD, but that's another study story altogether. But I think... while I appreciate the potency of TTFD and bimbotiamine, when we get to the chronic cases, there's a small percentage of them that can go directly to TTFD or bimbotiamine and do fantastically well and have remarkable results. The rest of the cases tend to have to titrate up first with a HCL assault, and then cross over to the others. And sometimes they do have to start with single milligram doses it's remarkable how disrupted their bodies become with chronic illness. Now, can they go to the hospital, and if they were to get IV thiamine, would that kickstart the enzymes sufficiently? Because obviously IV doesn't have to go first pass, it's a higher dose, and so it's absorbed, and et cetera, et cetera. And you can be monitored for electrolytes, possibly. But there are no physicians who currently practice that type of nutrient repletion relative to thiamine, relative to chronic illness. The only context in which you can hope to get thiamine in medicine is often only in acute care, in the ER, relative to, chronic alcoholism, sepsis, some of these dire positions. where it's recognized. Everyone else has to somewhat figure it out on their own, on their own, unfortunately.
Yeah. I want to quickly share my experience with just regular thiamine HCL. When I was researching some of the benefits of that in the Dr. Ray Pete forum, and I was researching, you know, some of the brain effects of thiamine HCL, some of its effects in the brain in terms of helping with acetylcholine, lowering glutamate, helping with GABA and things like that. And I remember when I started using just a small amount, like really small amount, I was breaking the 100 milligram thiamine HCLs into quarters, and I was just having that really small amount on its own. And this was, again, without any blood test. I was like, it's not going to cause any major harm at this dose. And I remember, honestly, through my experimentation, I remember after 1 week, I took a look back on the week and I'm like, wow, I've had a really productive week. My mental clarity is improved. I just feel less fatigued and I feel like I tolerate carbohydrates a lot better. So that was my general experience at the start with just regular thiamine HCL.
Yeah. And it is. It's a great energy boost. And if you have not been severely damaged by, you know, pharmaceuticals and a number of other variables that make your mitochondria function less than optimally, the benefits are typically remarkable. And sometimes there are cases where, you know, someone has been severely damaged and they can turn it around relatively quickly with the TTFD. Or the BEMPO, but oftentimes it's a longer process.
Let's talk about some of the depleting factors. Obviously, some compounds found within coffee.
Yes,
can deplete
coffee, tea, caffeic acid. Oh gosh, I just wrote these earlier today. The tannins in the coffees and the tea and the polyphenols deplete it. Alcohol obviously depletes it. There is a long, long list of medications that by various mechanisms deplete thiamine. One of the largest or most popular is metformin, which you know, is given for type 2 diabetes, which ironically, most type 2 diabetics are thiamine deficient before they even begin. And then they're given metformin. Metformin not only depletes thiamine because it blocks the thiamine transporter, it blocks folate and B12 and CoQ10. And so in individuals that take metformin, there's a lot of low-level mitochondrial damage that's going on that eventually accrues. In rodent studies and in tissue studies, they show that skeletal muscle ATP output is reduced by about 50% with metformin. I can't imagine functioning on 50% of your ATP. So that's one major. Antibiotics, there's a whole host of antibiotics that do it. There's the chemotherapeutic drugs do it. The acid drugs, antacid, yes, the PPIs do it. I would venture to say just about all drugs will deplete thiamine and other nutrients by one mechanism or another. We certainly know that all pharmaceuticals damage the mitochondria by various mechanisms. And so it would make sense that the damage alone would deplete or increase the need for these nutrients. But several of them deplete them directly by a transporter and by blocking enzymes and a variety of other things.
Right.
So those are the key variables, I think, that we just tend not to recognize in modern world. I mean, we that's why it's such a we think that thiamine deficiency is rare and limited to only individuals in the face of starvation, alcoholism, severe illness like with vomiting and diarrhea, or severe illness in which the metabolism is just, expedited and the demand is so great. But really, I think there's a lot of people walking around that don't even know it, that may have Frank deficiency, but more than likely have kind of a subclinical or suboptimal level and are one crisis away from that full on, thiamine deficiency illness. Mm. And you'll hear people say, I was healthy until, and then you go back and you look at, well, what was your level of health? How many medications were you on? Blah, blah, blah. And it turns out that they were functioning. They weren't necessarily healthy. They were functioning until X.
Yeah. That's great. Something that came to my mind is diagnostic testing for vitamin B1 deficiency. Do you want to look at, because I know we can sort of indirectly assess that someone may be B1 deficient. So what do people do now to assess?
Well, unfortunately, the laboratory measures are spurious at best. I just wrote a paper on that. I wish I had it in front of me. But the blood tests, you can measure different analytes in the blood or different portions, different media of the blood. So plasma, urine, and serum are the least accurate. Because they only contain about 10% of circulating thiamine. Okay, you want the erythrocytes, and the leukocytes, but the erythrocytes contain the 80-90% of it combined. And so you want to measure the erythrocyte level of the most active form of thiamine, which is thiamine pyrophosphate. And there are a couple methods that do that. They have, So the current laboratory methods that do the TPP include the
high profile liquid chromatography.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Now there's an enzyme I was just writing that was HACL, and that's why it kept getting switched in my head. That's the one in the peroxisome that is thiamine dependent and metabolizes fatty acids. The HPLC method is considered to be the most accurate because it was tested against the formerly most accurate one called the transketolase, the erythrocyte transketolase test. And it was found to be somewhat consistent with it. And because it's automatable, it is used more and more across the board. But the question is it really accurate? Does it detect deficiency? And there's a lot of evidence that it, unless it's severe deficiency, it may not be able to detect those borderline cases. And moreover, reference ranges are not consistent between labs. And so you may be deficient in lab A, but perfectly healthy in lab B.
Yeah.
So you've got those problems with it. And erythrocyte transketolase test, which is called a functional and indirect test, is no longer used except for experimentally and in university settings and research. But it measured the transketolase enzyme, the activity of the transketolase enzyme, which is thiamine dependent, which downregulates with diminished thiamine relative to by itself and then relative to the presence of thiamine to see the change in activity. And that was used for many decades as the gold standard, but it had some problems because it's time consuming. Frankly, it's just time consuming.
Yeah.
And there's a high degree of potential for user error, so to speak. And so it was replaced with the HPLC. Mm. So you can get different results and you may not be identified as thiamine deficient.
Right.
And so oftentimes what people are forced to do is go clinically, symptomatically. And if you have the symptoms and you suspect you are, then you start taking thiamine and see what happens.
Yeah.
If you're going to either get better or worse when you take thiamine, and in both cases, that's indicative of need. It's difficult. It's difficult actually to get practitioners to order a thiamine test too, frankly.
Yeah. What about peripherally, like in terms of other deficiencies? We know like vitamin C, bleeding gums, anemia, red sclera, like anything peripherally?
Oh, yeah, there's all kinds of things. So balance and gait are huge. If drunken sailor walk, even subtle changes in your ability to walk that straight line is indicative of a thiamine deficiency. Certainly fatigue is indicative. Balance issues, tremors, things like that. The more significant the deficiency is, the more likely you're going to have oculomotor eye nystagmus,
yep,
the bounce back in your eyes, and inability to focus and things like that. So there's a number of those that you can, again, that's clinical, symptomatically, they're all there. And I would suspect difficulty with sugar metabolism, cardiovascular symptoms, swelling in the peripheral limbs, pins and needles in the peripheral limbs. Historically, the Chinese called it, it's spelled, it translated to leg qi, or qi, leg qi. Because there was a disruption in the leg qi, because the symptoms usually would begin in the legs, with wet beriberi, which is the cardiovascular one, you get the swelling. With dry beriberi, you get no swelling, but you get peripheral neuropathies and such like that, and you get disturbed gait. And so that was the part of the descriptive process that they used, the early onset of the disease. And it started with the legs, and as it moved centrally, it was considered to be more severe and death would become imminent once it reached the heart. And in fact, it is once. Now, we're in modern times, we're able to offset that proposition of death, because people do get some degree of thiamine with any diet that they have, and they even get technically sufficient thiamine. So we have chronic morbidity as opposed to that acute mortality. But there does become a point in which it doesn't.
Yeah.
It just, you can't handle it anymore.
Right. You mentioned something around the tremors and the gaits, and I want to sort of link this in with Parkinson's disease. Obviously, this is not medical advice for those that are treating Parkinson's patients, but I know there was one pretty amazing study where they used, was it IV, vitamin B1?
Mm-hmm. Constantini, yeah, the Italian, who unfortunately perished with COVID last year. But yeah, his group of researchers did remarkable things with Parkinson's patients and high-dose thiamine. And they did thiamine HCL. Yes. I think they did a combination of both IV and oral. And they were looking about 1,500 to 2,000 milligrams per day for the patients. And there was a dramatic symptom diminishment relative to the thiamine use that would come back when they stopped it. So it was not a deficiency in the sense that it was absent. It was a deficiency in the sense that the enzymes didn't work without a high dose of thiamine constantly present.
Wow. Which means that there would have been some things blocking their enzymes from functioning, perhaps?
It could have been, or it could have been problems with transporters, or it could have been genetic, underpinnings. So there's genetic and epigenetic variables that will diminish the activity of various proteins involved in the usage of thiamine or any nutrient.
Yeah. Interesting. Okay. Yeah, I'm just trying to think about now, the perfect cocktail of nutrients to support mitochondrial function. I think one that I'm really fell in love with recently, I don't know if you've looked into it, is D-ribose.
I haven't looked into it, other than I had an individual who was thiamine deficient and had a lot of other deficiencies as well, but severely thiamine deficient, took D-ribose, and it sent him into a spiral. So it may not be the wonder.
A spiral, spiraling
declined.
He
declined significantly.
Wow, okay.
So, yeah, but I have not done the research on it.
Hmm. What about some of the other nutrients like carnitine and CoQ10, and things like
that? Certainly necessary. Well, to some people, they're necessary. I mean, they're necessary to everybody, frankly, but some people need to supplement them with them. Carnitine is particularly important in fatty acid metabolism, and you'll see carnitine deficiencies quite frequently. They could often go with thiamine deficiencies, but carnitine deficiencies, were they will have begun at a young age with muscle weakness and cramping and stuff like that, and they'll go undiagnosed for years and years and years, and as soon as the individual finds that it was in fact carnitine, and they take carnitine and it improves significantly. You also see carnitine deficiencies in pregnant women who develop hyperemesis, as well as thiamine deficiencies. Everything goes with thiamine, but carnitine deficiencies are impacted or are indicative of are associated with hyperemesis, cyclic vomiting, and other vomiting-related type of symptoms, as is CoQ10. And CoQ10 is interesting. There's a researcher by the name of Beatrice Golam who's done remarkable work with CoQ10 supplementation and Gulf War syndrome. That is a critical component of getting that electron transport chain activated. But if you have a deficiency up above, you're never going to get to the ETC. So, you know, you have to think of it sequentially. Yeah. And that's, again, why you have to come back to thiamine. You know, no matter what you do to correct and what you need down below, if you don't correct the first step, then you're still going to, you know, you'll get improvement, but you won't fully recover.
Well, it's the same sort of premise with like digestive disorders and digestive dysfunction is like if they have bacterial overgrowth or certain things downstream, we need to correct the low stomach acid if they have low stomach acid in the first place, right?
Well, there's a lot of things you have to, and you have to correct the diet again. You have to go back. You have, what got them to that point? And I find, again, that diet is something like religion. People are very unwilling to change. They're set on whatever their diet is. And some of the diets people are set on are not just junk food diets. I mean, that's an obvious one. But oftentimes, there are people who are undergoing a particular diet that is healthy for many people, but not healthy for them. You know, all of the vegetables, I mean, like tons and tons of vegetables, you know, and vegetable smoothies and that. If you have low thiamine, you're going to end up creating oxalate. And if you have oxalate, you're going to get all sorts of problems. So while that may be healthy for some, it's not healthy for, you know, everyone. Similar, you know, carnivore diet, big time, you know, fad and great, but if you have a carnitine deficiency, you're not going to be able to metabolize any of the fats from those meats, and that's going to wreak havoc on your system. If you have a thiamine deficiency, you're not going to be able to do any of the fats. You know, so there's you know, it's there's a lot of diets that could be healthy for some people, but they're not healthy for everybody. But once someone decides that this diet is healthy for them, they're very reticent to change, despite all evidence to the contrary.
Yeah. There's one point just quickly you brought up around oxalates. I do want to ask your expertise around how oxalates can damage the mitochondria, or like the implications there, if there's any research.
So I haven't done a lot of work on oxalates other than relative to thiamine deficiency creating them. But oxalate management, I mean, oxalates, if they're not metabolized appropriately, store in the body, and anything that stores in the body that shouldn't store in the body is going to damage the mitochondria. But that's a very surface level understanding, and so I apologize, that's just not my area, other than broad strokes.
Yeah,
on that one.
I think the main point to drive home there with the diets is I guess an individualized approach is most important, and there's no blanket diet that's going to
be appropriate for everyone. So it's key to understand.
Other than avoid junk food. I mean, that's really that's I think is a blanket recommendation, is avoid the high processed, high carbohydrate, high trans fat, you know, high chemical foods.
Yeah, yeah. And all the preservatives and flavors and things like that.
Yeah, so, all of those things. Yeah. If your food's not real food, then it's not doing you any good.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Well, Chandler, was there any sort of other areas you wanted to discuss, maybe around what you've recently researched, any other key topics you've been really passionate about lately?
Well, I think we covered it. And I think what I'm most passionate about is the fact that you cannot heal with medications. While medications are certainly useful in certain instances and can be life-saving, they don't treat the disease per se. They don't correct anything. They override things. Mm. And you've got to get to that root cause of what's causing, you know, of what's eliciting that reaction that is necessitating the medication. And so I think when you're dealing with chronic health issues, the idea that you can apply more and more medications, or that if you just find the right medication, all will be well, is misguided. And I think I would like people to look at their mitochondria from the mitochondria outward and ask whether the mitochondria are functioning sufficiently, and use that as your template to become healthy, rather than simply blanketing the body with more and more medications.
Mm, that's brilliant. That's a powerful drive home message. So Chandler, where can my listeners connect with you, or view some of your resources, your website? Where can they learn more?
So there's a couple different places. So as you may know, with my colleague, Dr. Derek Lonsdale, we wrote a book called Thymine Deficiency Disease, Dysautonomia, and High Calorie Malnutrition, that is available on Amazon or Elsevier, which the publisher. And that details it much more coherently than I have portrayed on this interview, all the mechanisms by which thymine is needed in the body and all the pathways that go haywire when it's absent and the symptoms and et cetera. That is really your guidebook to understanding thymine, the mitochondria, the autonomic system, etc. So that's one way. I run a website called Hormones Matter. The name originated again from my background in endocrinology and has evolved as such. There we have basically two types of articles. We do research and commentary, research analysis and commentary on research, patient case stories, from patients that are struggling to patients that have recovered. And because I think the struggle is important. So my goal with that is one, to offer a take on research that perhaps is not your standard take. We dive deep into different research areas. But two, to give individuals a voice regarding their own health. And I think it's critically important to build the knowledge base regarding the diversity of symptoms and illnesses that are experienced by the greater population, many of which do not fit within the nice, neat little boxes, diagnostic boxes that we try to fit them into. And most of these individuals have been so severely damaged by Western medicine that I think it's important for them to be able to tell what has happened, what's going on, and hopefully drive research into these diseases or these disease processes in a different way than we do that is confined to current diagnostic parameters. So long-winded story, research analysis, case histories. And the case histories are written by the patients themselves. So it's called Hormones Matter. That's where you get it. On Facebook, we have, well, I have the Facebook page for Hormones Matter, but we also have a private Facebook group called Understanding Mitochondrial Nutrients. It's a private group that basically discusses nutrients and recovery. We have both researchers, physicians, and patients, and there's interactions on any number of topics related to recovering health. It does not give medical advice, so if you're looking for medical advice, that's not a place to go. But we do discuss, you know, different pathways to recovery.
Awesome.
So those are the primary ways.
Cool. Well, I'll make sure to leave those linked in the show notes. And yeah, I think what you're doing is something great, and I really respect your work. And I've learned a lot from you, and I know my listeners today would have gained a little bit of insight into, you know, the work you've published. And yeah, I just want to say massive thanks for coming on the show.
Okay. Very good. Thank you for having me.
Great.
Thank you everyone for joining in to today's episode. For in-depth show notes and lessons learned, visit nofilter.media/boostyourbiology.
This has been a No Filter Media production.
Say what you want.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.